All right, we decided to change it up a little bit. I like that. It's that is Let There Be Drums, and it's just a different take on our normal theme, and I have to say I do like it, man. Maybe I'll get Teddy to find me about 100 different versions of it, and we'll keep on going. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'll tell you what, we've got a very hard-hitting lineup today, so we're going to jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Ratner. Michael's the President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we're going to be talking with Michael about Bradley Manning and his recent appearance in a military courtroom for a pretrial hearing. But first, and this is something that should be near and dear to the hearts of all the listeners of this show or anybody who cares about honest journalism and the importance of truth in being able to understand the world in order to change it. We're going to be talking about a new book that rips off the cover of all the censorship and distortion of the news that's fed to us on a daily, even hourly basis in this country. It's the new edition of the top censored stories and media analysis of 2011 and 2012. It's Censored from Project Censored. It's Censored 2013 Dispatches from the Media Revolution. It's an incredible book. I spent the last couple of days reading it and really was so caught up in it. Learned a lot, got angry a lot, got bothered a lot, which is actually a good thing, as Ray Bradbury says, and as he's quoted in the beginning of this book, puts it all on a whole different level. And joining us to talk about this is Dr. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, a media research program that every year publishes this book. It's a ranking of the most censored nationally important news stories. And Andy is based up in the Bay Area, and he's here to talk with us about why you should give a damn about what's in this book. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's a pleasure to join you.
Sure. Why don't you explain to people Project Censored, what it does, and what's behind this book?
Well, Project Censored is, we've been doing our thing for 36 years now. We were established in 1976 at Sonoma State University in Northern California when a student in Dr. Carl Jensen's class on media communication, a student asked Professor Jensen a question that he felt he didn't have a good answer to, which was, how was it possible in the face of what was known at the time of the 1972 election about Watergate and the war in Vietnam, how was it possible that Nixon was so readily reelected? And Carl Jensen and his unsatisfied with the, you know, how could the media have contributed to that re-election? And so Carl Jensen and the founder of Project Censored and his students began looking at media coverage, corporate media coverage in the United States to see what was omitted, what was suppressed, what was covered in only a partial, incomplete sort of way. And Project Censored has been doing that ever since. A combination, I always think of it as, on one hand, a critique of the corporate media when they fall short of their task as the Fourth Estate, and a celebration, on the flip side, a celebration of the courageous work of independent investigative journalists who bring forward the stories the corporate media doesn't want to deal with or will only deal with in a partial sort of way.
It's interesting, too, Andy, because you bring forward, I mean, it's true, you bring forward these stories and you publish what have been the most censored topics over the last year. But you also do it not just in terms of referencing the stories and citing the stories and giving people access to them, but you also have sections like Truth Emergency, Deconstructing Narratives of Power to Reclaim the Common Good. You have things organized in terms of, which we'll talk about in a minute, but in terms of the sort of the groups of censored stories and what people can tell by that grouping. You have the Project Censored International, Case Studies of Unhistory in the Making, which I wanted to talk about too. But let's talk about this now. You actually group these censored stories into categories. And I thought that was really interesting, your explanation for that, which was something about providing sort of not just the sense of individual stories that were being lied to or hidden from us, but also that there's sort of a trend. You can discern where a trend is going on. How did you come up with this thing of grouping them in these clusters?
Well, this was a relatively recent innovation in Project Censored's kind of work. A few years ago, the current director of Project Censored, Mickey Huff, and the previous director, Peter Phillips, were looking at our top 25 list and saying, you know, the top 25 is very useful. People love lists. Lists are kind of interest-provoking. And we continue to produce every year a list of the top 25 stories. But there was also a sense of Well, there are larger themes that don't get captured. And this is a this would be one of the critiques of the corporate media, is this kind of isolated story. And what we're often lacking would be something that would connect the dots between a handful of stories. And so we started doing what we call these censored news clusters that look at the broader themes that, depending on the metaphor you want, that link together, or the broader themes that are in some sense the foundation for the specifics or the backdrop against which the specifics of the top 20, individual top 25 stories make sense. And so we're really trying to put things in a bigger context by looking at these individual stories in terms of these censored news clusters, connecting the dots.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is it's you mentioned corporate media, and you're talking about sort of the failings of the corporate media. But in a lot of places, the thing that comes through to me is actually the complicity of the corporate media. And I was thinking recently, as I was reading the book, I was thinking about that Flobot song about there's a war going on for your mind, and how they're actually that is really reflected in society, concentrated in the way different various news stories are told or not told.
That's absolutely true. And it's, you know, we just passed a little over a month ago, we just passed the 35th anniversary of Carl Bernstein's Rolling Stone piece on how the CIA had co-opted many of the most prominent branches of the institutions in the corporate media of the United States. And it's quite interesting to me that Bernstein didn't run that story until he himself had left the New York Times. And it wasn't until he was at Rolling Stone that he could publish a piece exposing what had been a long-term project of his, the ways in which that there was absolute complicity and co-option of some of the most heralded institutions of journalism in the United States by CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk as we get into some of the top 25 stories that would be opportunities to talk about that theme of the complicity of the corporate media in more specific detail, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's really important because it is a lot of times we just look at it as sort of there's the, well, they fail to cover this or they're not doing their job, when actually in a certain sense they are doing their job in terms of their, they talk about the fourth estate, but it's the fourth estate of an overall system that has a sense of we need to actually, you know, that there needs to be some kind of control of thinking and of what people have at their disposal, what they know, how do they understand. For instance, you're not going to find something that really gets into and tells you just how things work here and what you need to do to change it all. You know, that's not going to be out there.
And a word on the terminology. In the Censored 2013 book, and when I make visits to school classrooms and so forth, we always make a point of talking about specifically the corporate media. We don't use the term mainstream media because we don't believe that the corporate media actually reflects the interests of the mainstream. And so it's a very specific usage on our part to identify the corporate media as such and to leave as a matter for discussion, does the corporate media represent a mainstream viewpoint, or is it in fact, you know, relating to the themes of Occupy, is the corporate media really more in the business of representing the interests of the 1%?
Mm-hmm. All right, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Andy Roth about Project Censored's new book, this year's book, Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution, the top censored stories in the country, and also includes some stuff internationally and a lot of stuff that's really worth checking out on that theme of censorship and how to break through it and where it is being broken through, which I think is extremely important, too. Now, Andy, we're going to get into some of these stories that I want to that you have in the book that I think are... You know, it's interesting. It's you reading them, and as much as I pay attention to what's going on, I have to say that a lot of times things just slap me in the head in this book that I said, whoa, wait a minute, really that? And one of the first ones you talk about is the signs of an emerging police state, which I've been fairly cognizant of, but not to the degree that's covered in your book. Let's talk about that, signs of an emerging police state, and even the fact that actually the top censored story has to do with the with this question, with the police state.
Mm-hmm. And this relates in some sense to the image on the cover of the book, which is an image of the UC Davis police officer who was pepper spraying the student protesters who were protesting in a completely legal, nonviolent way. And the image on our cover of the book is that iconic pepper spray hitting the seated students as they try to shield their faces. But the way we framed the cover image is to highlight all the people standing by with personal cameras and cell phones, and they're documenting the wrongdoing. And so that's one side of, you know, so there are two sides of it. If we talk about signs of an emerging police state, we have, on one hand, you know, we as a population are increasingly monitored. Our police are increasingly militarized at the expense of our civil liberties. And we can track that, of course, back to the 2001 Patriot Act. But what makes that our number one story this year were the passage in 2012 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows the military to detain indefinitely without trial any U.S. citizen that the government might label as a terrorist or an accessory to terrorism. And the Senate is working, I think, to reform that. But even the way they're doing that is problematic because they're ignoring, even as they reform it to perhaps protect U.S. citizens from indefinite detention, we've lost ground in the sense of the idea that anyone is subject to indefinite detention by the government is a fundamental violation of the principle of habeas corpus, which is a foundation of the rule of law, not only in the United States, but going all the way back to the Magna Carta of 1215. And as Mickey Huff, the director, liked to point out, that's not quarter past noon, that's the year 1215. So we're talking about legislation that calls into question fundamental principles of being a nation under the rule of law. My favorite one on this signs of emerging police state, you have to sometimes find things to smile about in the midst of the heaviness. Another component of the emerging police state is that since 2010, the Department of Homeland Security has run a program called If You See Something, Say Something. And that campaign encourages members of the public to report suspicious activity to their local authorities. And it's deeply problematic because some of what Department of Homeland Security identifies as suspicious activity includes things like the constitutionally protected right to criticize the government, to engage in nonviolent protest. And what there is to smile in a tragicomic way about this is, I think it's quite revealing that the DHS, If You See Something, Say Something campaign is actually a registered trademark. There's
okay.
A little, whenever you see that phrase, if you see something, say something, it will be all caps and it will have the little PM after it. So it's kind of, to me, that's emblematic of the sort of, if we're talking about the emergence of a police state, also it's sort of symbolic or emblematic of the kind of corporate and commercial dimensions of this as well.
Well, you know, I just bought a pair of eyeglasses and somehow on the inside of my lenses, that's what I see is if you see something, say something. You know, so where are we going with this, man? But here's the thing, or it's like that movie They Live, right? You get these glasses and suddenly you're seeing that everywhere. But here's a question, because there's one of the things about this basically the Department of Homeland Security's campaign, there is also tied into that this total information awareness question. And this is one of the things I think that a lot of people just do not even, it's not even on the horizon in people's sights in terms of what they know about or what they're thinking about. I mean, here they are, it's one thing they're creating this whole mess of good Germans, but that's part of an entire working complex that they have, this thing that they're building, this Utah complex, and then the Catalyst software, the eye in the sky. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, this is a contribution. This is, you mentioned earlier that in addition to the top 25, we have other sections of the censored 2013 book, and one of these is what we call the Truth Emergency section. And the Total Information War is a contribution to that Truth Emergency section by Dr. Elliot Cohen. And in this chapter, this brief but powerful chapter, he documents kind of the deep history leading to the desire on the part of our government for what is a program of, quote, total information awareness. And so this is everything from, as you mentioned, this massive facility for gathering and analyzing data in Utah now, all the way through we battled and we continue to battle over versions of the Stop Online Piracy Act. And again, going back to more legislation, the National Defense Resources Preparedness Executive Order that Obama decreed gives the government legal authority to install government equipment inside electronic communication service providers. So the giant telecom companies are in some ways serving, as Cohen documents, as conduits for the government exercise of power and the control over mass data. the transport of it and indeed the analysis of it. So, you know, there's much more in Eliot's chapter than we could cover even if we devoted a whole program to it, but that gives you just a kind of a finger-pointing-at-the-moon glimpse of some of the issues at stake in what he describes, I think, without any hyperbole, as a campaign towards total information awareness.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Andy Roth about Project Censored's new book, Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution. Andy, it's interesting because, you know, a few years ago you looked at The Matrix and you thought, well, this is interesting, and it might have felt a little bit uneasy, but now it's like, oh, wait a minute, you know,
Yeah.
Or, you know, many years ago when Brazil came out, and I'll never forget, you know, you're in a mall, hello, citizens. We are looking for, you know, this is actually stuff that's becoming real. And you think about this in terms of what they're actually trying to do and what they're capable of doing. And people, by not knowing about this, people actually are unable to actually even counter it in any way, even in their personal life. And it's a very, very disturbing development here.
And so this is one reason, for instance, going back to a bit we touched on earlier, one reason that we've gone to the news clusters in addition as a kind of an interpretive framework to talk about particular stories like signs of an emerging police state. That's part of our news cluster on the police state and civil liberties that connects those signs to a host of other stories that also kind of, triangulate around the tension between, on one hand, the claims of you know, all these policies and programs as necessary for our national security, and on the other hand, deep concern voiced in many sectors of our society by many kinds of different kinds of people about, well, what about our civil liberties? What about our rights to privacy? What about our rights to free speech and association? And so the police state and civil liberties cluster, news cluster, and Eliot Cohen's chapter on total information awareness, there's a kind of affinity between those, I think.
And you were saying those things you were talking about were our rights to, I mean, wow, I was, come on, man. It's like glimmers of the past, you know. That's the sense you get in this. It's like really, sort of these things have been wiped away. And actually, just one more thing on this, and we can do this very quickly, but I also thought, you know, here's the point. 5 of your top 25 censored stories are concerned with this police state and civil liberties. And one of the two of the things that actually really were very interesting was in terms of the instruments of legal suppression and oppression, the FBI, the New York Police Department, the amount of actual creation of crime that is going on. And in a way, this whole thing of sort of like revving people up to do, getting people to do something and then sort of busting them for it. And this is actually becoming a more and more common occurrence.
This is our number 4 story, is that a majority of the terrorist plots that have been foiled in the United States recently have actually been instigated by agents working with the FBI, moles, and informants. This is an unusual approach to ensure that the U.S. is secure from future terrorist attacks. This is a story that was brought forward by investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley, and also Mother Jones, who did a joint study. And they've documented in really powerful, first-class journalistic ways. The FBI has a pool of approximately 15,000 spies and moles who have infiltrated various communities under the guise of uncovering terrorist plots, but often the moles are actually encouraging and assisting people in committing the very crimes that they then bust those people for. And this is one of those stories that I think is so important in terms of the theme you raised at the beginning of the hour, the complicity of the corporate media. As a strategy to convince the American public that we're doing well on the war against domestic terror, it would fail if the corporate media didn't cooperate in reporting what government spokespeople claim without questioning, without checking those claims. Mm-hmm. So one of the things the corporate media hasn't done, but the independent investigative journalists are doing a much better job of it. So all these arrests of alleged terrorists and alleged terrorist plots eventually go to court, and most of those cases get thrown out by the judges as having no merit. The corporate media have tended to emphasize the cases that do go to trial and that result in a verdict, but they have downplayed significantly that the majority of those cases don't even go to trial. Judges mm-hmm. just toss them out as saying this was a setup, and it's not worthy of a trial.
And then on the other hand,
that's a really interesting that in our ongoing quote war on terror, the role of the media the corporate media is complicit in kind of giving the American people a distorted view of what's happening is something that we can dispel that simply by becoming aware of the process through which it's done, and that the process has little to no legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dr. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, and we're talking about their new book, Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution. Now, Andy, there's so much more to talk about. I'm going to have you back later to talk about this again. But let's continue on with this. And I just wanted to mention one thing in relation to this, you know, the point about the FBI and these law enforcement agencies, you know, actually setting people up. It's also very heavy that, you know, you're talking when you're looking about when you're looking at the NYPD and stop and frisk in New York, which has become a very big thing. And the fact that one of the stories that you guys actually also highlight is how the NYPD is, in fact, planting drugs on many of the people that they stop. And while the media has covered to a certain extent, not excessively, they've covered something about stop and frisk most recently, they have not covered this aspect of actually the New York police planting things on people and setting them up for busting and really giving life to that whole pipeline to prison question.
Right. I mean, that's a story that we do bring forward. That's our number 19 story this year. And it received coverage mostly in, Alternet covered it a little bit online. The Gothamist, which is, as its name suggests, cover local New York City issues. It's really been covered more as a local story in some ways, even though it's of national importance. It is a clear case of overreach and, again, fundamental notions of what it means to be a society under the rule of law are open for question when the people, the officials charged with enforcing the law, are setting people up to be to fall victim of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's a crucial story and one. There's so many stories. This is maybe a good place for me to make a plug, if I might, to say that we have summaries of all of the top 25, not only from the 2013 book, but going all the way back to the first list in 1976. All that and more can be found on our website, which is at projectcensored.org.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're being tantalized by some of the things we're discussing quickly today, obviously support Pacifica and KPFK by making a donation and getting the book, but you can also find a lot of our material online at projectcensored.org.
And it's definitely something that people should do. It's definitely something that people need to check out. Now, you know, Andy, we're running out of time, but I wanted to actually, you know, there were a couple things I wanted to talk about, and there are two questions left that I'll get into. I was going to talk about the oceans, but, you know, we've covered a lot of that and not enough, but people really need to read the book and find out how that story is actually being distorted and ignored in a lot of ways. But there's one in the cluster called Human Costs of War and Violence, and in particular around Libya and human rights abuses. And the whole question of this war that was unleashed on Libya and what's behind it and what was going on, you know, this is something that I think for a lot of people, across the board, it was one of those things that reminded me of sort of like I just interviewed the Central Park Five filmmakers and two of the defendants last week. And it reminded me a lot of the sort of the media onslaught that happened around Libya, reminded me a lot of the kind of media onslaught that happened around the Central Park Five back when these kids were first, you know, arrested and accused of this horrendous rape and everything else. And, you know, in the case of Libya, there were a lot of people who should have known better who actually stood out there and said, well, America is saying that this is so bad and we've got to go in for human rights help. We have to help all those humans that were suffering there. And they went in and they just terrorized the hell. They just destroyed this entire country, killed how many, responsible for the death of how many people. And that's a story that, one, again, it shows this complicity question, but also the fact that people need to actually open their eyes and they actually have to have an approach to the media and what's being told to us of like seeking the truth in all this. I thought this was one of the very important stories that you guys included. I was pleased to see it as well.
Yeah, thank you. I'll just touch on, there are like eight different independent reports that make up our number eight story, NATO war crimes in Libya. Let me just touch on one of them as an example of what Michael's talking about here. In July 2011, NATO aircraft bombed Libya's main water supply facility. And this water supply facility was one of the major projects Libya had undertaken over the past decade. Fresh water, of course, is never to be taken for granted. In this case, the water supply facility was one that served approximately 70% of Libya's population. And NATO bombed it. The bombing of infrastructure like that is, I think, a fairly straightforward instance of what would be considered a war crime. It's beyond a doubt not something in service of humanitarian principles, which were allegedly the impetus for NATO involvement in Libya. And this is an important story to talk about, not just because it happened in Libya and we shouldn't forget, but also because the patterns that we saw in Libya seem to be, although they are distinct countries and cultures and societies, much of what we saw in Libya seems to be playing out in Syria as we speak. And so reporting in this regard by the folks at Global Research out of Canada has been really cutting edge. And so Global Research helps to bring forward several of the stories in our report on NATO war crimes in Libya.
All right, Andy. And now to close out, let's talk about the McRib and its place in the situation with journalism today.
So this is part of our junk food news, quite literally junk food. This was a category that Carl Jensen developed in response to claims from the corporate media. Once Project Censor was underway, people in the corporate media said, well, wait, this isn't fair. You know, we can't cover everything. There are only so many column inches of text on the page and so many minutes in the hour. And Carl and his students then began looking at, well, what do the corporate media cover? And the conclusion was much of it is junk food or the news equivalent of. So one of our junk food stories this year is the corporate media abuzz about the return of the McRib, the, quote, rib-like sandwich, which is actually a pork shoulder that has been retired six times since 2004. So its return in 2011-2012 had the AP, the CNN, USA Today, Fox News, a plethora of coverage of the McRib and its return. The problem with this is, while we were fixated, if you were paying attention to corporate media, while you were fixated on corporate coverage of the McRib story, we weren't hearing about a court decision that compelled Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE, to disclose an internal memo that claimed that racial profiling and deportation policies were, in fact, legal policies. So, as always, so the corporate media has seemed, in the case of the McRib, to be more interested in informing Americans about a product than informing them about what government is doing behind closed doors as it relates to things like immigration policy and such. So it's a kind of quintessential junk food case.
Yeah, and you know what? As you're talking, I'm conjuring up a nation of Homer Simpsons. And since you said McRib, all I can see is a bunch of people going, McRib. All that other stuff you're talking about, McRib. Okay. Andy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Michael.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Andy Lee Roth. And we've been talking with Andy about Project Censored's new book, and that's Censored 2013, The Top Censored Stories and Media Analysis of 2011-2012, Dispatches from the Media Revolution. And again, that's from Project Censored. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Michael Ratner, the President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we're going to be talking about Bradley Manning and his recent appearance before a military court for a pre-trial hearing. So stay tuned.
Find the patterns sifting through. As he read the data, the patterns did emerge. Patterns that were clear both before and since the surge. Patterns of abuse of the most horrific kind. gunning down civilians out of view and out of mind, gunning down the opposition in the middle of the night, sending off the scholars to be tortured out of sight. Sometimes you need desperate measures when you live in desperate times. Private Manning's all he was, looking at war crimes. He wondered what to do to allow the dead to speak. He finally decided to contact WikiLeaks. Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows the emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes. Now Adrian Lamo has to live within his skin. He stabbed Bradley in the back, called the cops and turned them in, but not before the soldier took half a million files. If you printed all the pages, they'd stretch on for miles. Evidence against the state, right from the horse's mouth. Machinations in the west, bombings in the south. A treasure trove of details for all the globe to see. How much they need to lie and kill for democracy. How many drone strikes have hit villages, leaving everyone to die? They blamed on someone else, the official line, not I. How many coups have been plotted by ambassadors who say that free and fair elections be the order of the day? Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows the emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes.
Welcome back. That was David Rovics with Song for Bradley Manning.
Bradley Manning, the U.S. Army private who was accused of leaking hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks, has been in jail in a U.S. military prison for 2.5 years. He faces 22 counts, and he could face life in prison if he's convicted of the most serious of those counts. And it's just a, you know, this is an incredible exposure of the brutality behind the U.S. regime and what's going on in all of the, you know, in the prisons, but in particular in relation to this whole war on the world that America has been embarked on for quite some time. Joining us now to talk about about Bradley Manning and what's been going on with Bradley Manning, his recent hearing, is Michael Ratner. Michael's the emeritus president of Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, you know, one of the things that comes up with this is this situation with Bradley Manning has been, I mean, it's been condemned by the UN. It's been, you know, there's been a lot of exposure around it in, you know, press around the world. Even Obama's, one of Obama's former State Department spokesmen quit denouncing what's being done to Bradley Manning. And yet they continue to do this. Now, you've attended the hearing for Bradley Manning, which was the first time that anyone ever really got a chance to hear from him directly. What did you find there?
Well, I think you gave an accurate summary. He's been in prison for 2.5 years. What he allegedly released were files and documents from the Afghan war logs to the Iraq war logs to the collateral murder video to the State Department cables that just showed the utter criminality, hypocrisy, and corruption of our government and governments actually around the world. And, of course, they want to punish him, along with the person I represent, Julian Assange, as well as Jeremy Hammond, who was the alleged hacker of what's called the Stratford documents, which were the private intelligence company Stratford. They want to punish these three people, two of them whistleblowers and one of them a publisher, severely. And what they have done with Bradley Manning is really dramatic. And the hearings that I've been attending over the last while have concerned his pretrial detention and the conditions under which he was held. And as you said, it was the first time that he actually took the stand. And I happened to be lucky enough to be in the courtroom at that moment. It's not like I've gone every day, although there are some heroic journalists that are going every day, which you can bet they're not the New York Times and the Washington Post, but some journalists out there who are really doing some amazing coverage. So I was there, and we heard some witnesses. Oh, let me just back up for a second. The reason for this hearing on what happened to him pre-trial, and of course he's still in pre-trial, though he's better conditions now, is that the lawyer for Bradley Manning, David Coombs, has made what's called a motion or an argument in the court that all charges ought to be dismissed because Bradley Manning was treated so badly, the equivalent of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, if not torture. and that therefore all charges ought to be dismissed because the government has such dirty hands here. He also made the argument that if the judge isn't going to dismiss it, that if he's ever convicted of the charges here, he should get 10 days off of his sentence for every day that he had to spend in these horrendous conditions, which would amount to a fair number of years, 6 or 7 years off the sentence. So here we are sitting in this small courtroom in Fort Meade. There's a bunch of guys in dress blue uniforms sitting, you know, in front of the bar. We're in the wooden benches behind. It's a very small courtroom. I mean, you know, it's a third of the size of the normal courtroom. I mean, very small is all I can say. Windowless. And you have these guys in these dress blue uniforms that look like those Civil War uniforms with a little epaulette on the shoulder. And Bradley is sitting at the table almost where you can reach out and touch him. And he looks good. He's in his dress uniform, a white shirt, tie, haircut, glasses. And the first couple of witnesses that I heard were the psychiatrists who treated Bradley Manning. And they were interesting because what they said is the time that Manning was held at both Kuwait, but in particularly in Quantico in Virginia, which altogether is about a year, the first year of his captivity, the time that he was held, they recommended that he not be held in these punitive conditions. They recommended that he not be held in a suicide watch or in a preventive detention, preventive of injury situation, because they said he is no more likely to hurt himself or commit suicide than any other normal member of this population. And despite these psychiatrists' recommendations, Brig Prison at Quantico, as well as in Kuwait, continued to hold Bradley Manning in what can only be described as torturous conditions. And they said it was the first time in their history, the first time that their recommendations of taking someone out from that so-called set of conditions was ever disregarded. So that was also, that was pretty dramatic. And I figured, okay, I'm there for the day. That's pretty remarkable. We come back from lunch. And then David Coombs says, "Will Bradley Manning please take the witness stand?" And, you know, you could have heard a pin drop in that room. And Bradley Manning gets on the witness stand with tremendous dignity. I want to stress, he just looked, I mean, really dignified and, you know, was well, and just, it was just very impressive. And David Coombs starts by asking him, saying, "Look, we know you might be a bit nervous, but I'll ease you into it." And then they start with his arrest. In May of 2010, when he's in Iraq, he's taken to Kuwait very quickly. And I'll describe very quickly what happens in Kuwait. In Kuwait, first, he doesn't know why he's been arrested or taken in. He just knows that they've taken him away from his job and put him into and take him to Kuwait. In Kuwait, he's put into what he called an animal cage, 8 by 8 by 8, and it's in a tent. And there's two animal cages, the one he's in and the one next to him. And there's no one in the other one next to him, and obviously it's not so light in the tent. And he's stuck in this animal cage. And he mostly had to stay in that animal cage for 2 months. And when you hear the next part, they would wake him up every night at 11 o'clock at night, and they would keep him up all night, and he would go to sleep about 1 in the afternoon. So you have basically a reversal of the normal patterns of sleep, which obviously injured him tremendously. And he said, "I didn't know day from night or night from day." And so they keep him in these conditions. And, of course, he eats in this animal cage, et cetera. And he thought he was going to, as he's quoted, he's saying, he said he started to fall apart under these conditions. And he said, "I thought I was going to die in these animal cages." And from then, 2 months almost in here, from then he gets taken to Quantico in Virginia. He doesn't know where he's going when they put him on the plane, and he was so fearful he thought he was going to go to Guantanamo. But he gets to Quantico, and he gets put into another cage. This is a cell, but it's, you know, has a mesh in front of it. Nobody else on the row of cells he's in, so he's, in other words, he's in solitaire. And he gets, David Coombs, the lawyer, has him get off the witness stand, and on the floor, they use a ruler and some other props to draw out what that cell was like. And I'm telling you, first, Manning's testimony, you know, this is not, Bradley Manning is not the flake or disturbed person that is painted in our media. This man is smart, articulate, self-aware, and dignified. And he's not who you expected to hear. Even I, who am close to these cases, particularly because I'm so involved in all three of these, in a way. I mean, with Julian Assange, J. Jeremy Hammond and Bradley. But it's not what I expected. And he's worldly. When they asked him, what kind of books do you want to read, he mentions Dawkins, you know, the Absence of God book or whatever he wrote, mm-hmm. and other people like that. He mentioned Howard Zinn. This was a really interesting man. So he gets back to where we were. They take him off the witness stand. He shows on the floor where the cell is. It's 8x6, wire mesh front, concrete blocks on the side, a little bed coming out the wall that has what's called a suicide mattress on it, which is a hard, uncomfortable mattress. There's props on the floor. There's the suicide smock he was forced to wear, which is essentially a straitjacket that he had to wear in the evenings. It goes down to his legs. His arms are free, but it's a stiff, hard jacket that goes all the way over his body down to his legs. Suicide blanket, suicide jacket. Then they say to him, where's the toilet? Well, the toilet they show is on one of the walls of this 8x6 prison. Above it is the sink. When he goes to the bathroom, there's a wire mesh in front, and there's a guard outside who sees everything he does in that, including going to the bathroom. And there's an observation booth on the also across the hall, just on the other side, in which there's lights and a guard all the time, and there's a 24-hour light on him. So he's completely exposed every second. He doesn't have any toilet paper in the cell. Apparently they thought, or someone thought, well, you can commit suicide with toilet paper, you can swallow it or something. Mm. So when he wants toilet paper, he has to stand in front of the prison cell, behind the bars or the mesh, and say, PFC Manning requesting toilet paper of Lance Corp or whatever who is out there. And it's like completely demeaning, utterly demeaning. So he does that while he's off the witness stand, and he shows us that. And then he talks about what else happened in that cell. During the day, Manning he was allowed to be up during the day, but he was considered on duty. So while he's in the cell, 23.5 hours a day he's in that cell. He gets 20 minutes or so of what's called sunshine exercise, taken out in a three-piece suit, which is the chains on the legs, the waist, and the arms. Gets taken out in that. But while he's in the cell with 23.5 hours a day, of course, there's nothing to do in there, nothing to read, nothing. And he is not allowed to, let's say what he's allowed to do. He's allowed to stand, and he's allowed to sit on his rack or bed with his feet on the floor for 8, 10, 12 hours a day. He can't lean back. He can't lay down. He's on duty. So that's what you call a stress position. That's, typical stress position of a torture technique. And then we'll go to what my conclusion is from some of this, and then we'll talk about his clothes. But then when he goes to sleep at night, the bright light from out in the hall is on him 24 hours a day. Of course, there's no natural light in this whole place. And he has to sleep with his feet at the bottom of the bed and his head facing toward the bar, the bars or the mesh, and the light. So it's very hard to go to sleep. If he turns away from the light, they come into his cell, and they wake him up, or they push him around toward the light. So here you have stress positions, 23 hours a day in solitaire, a light on him all the time, suicide jackets on him, and then in another dramatic moment, they put up a video of him when he was forced to take off his clothing and be naked. So they show this video of three beefy Marine guards in front of the cell, and Bradley Manning, who's only 5'2", on the other side of the cell, and they're telling him to take off all his clothes, and you put him in like a mail slot that has a tray in the middle of the bars, and they go out to the other side, and then he's stark naked. And they show this in the video. Of course, they only show him in the video from the waist up. But there you have these techniques. Nudity, forced nudity, stress position, standing all the time, the light on him all the time, solitary all the time. And when you look back, and in my experience, of course, I represented Guantanamo detainees, and you see what they had to suffer at Guantanamo, we called those the Rumsfeld techniques. Those are stress positions that constitute torture, certainly cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And Manning was treated like this between Kuwait and Quantico for a year. So it was to watch it and sit there for me was devastating. I was in tears half the time. Manning was able to describe it in great detail and with great equanimity.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights, a lawyer for Julian Assange, and he is just back from attending Bradley Manning's first hearing related to the charges that he's facing for basically leaking hundreds of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks. Now, Michael, one of the things, I'm glad you brought up this Rumsfeld technique, because that was one of the things that really struck me about this. And even everything that you're describing is so clearly torture, you know, and it's so clearly illegal in any book, you know. I mean, the UN has actually assaulted what was going on. And yet, you know, it seems everything is just rolling over like this. What do you think about that?
Now, I really wish I knew what to make of it. You know, his lawyer, David Coombs, and I spoke yesterday, and David described it as criminal, what was done to him. David is not, you know, he's not a political progressive like I am. He's a good, solid civilian, former military defense counsel. And he said it was criminal, and he's something that will stay in America. But what's shocking to me is here you have this alternative press there, a lot of it. I mean, you have Fire Dog Lake, Politico, some other presses there, but you don't have the Washington Post, the New York Times, and others covering the trial of an American citizen who's being tortured while he's in custody. And it's utterly shocking to me. I mean, this is appalling. I mean, this shows how this country has become inured to torture after 10 or 11 years of it after 9/11, and how they are willing to just overlook it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that goes both for the press, which has, I think, especially the mainstream press, has quite a tie into the idea of promoting or protecting a lot of what the system overall does. I mean, you think about this, and I just saw the Central Park Five film, and I was just, I had interviewed them on last Friday, and I was thinking about, God, I remember living in New York at the time, living on the East Coast at the time, and the free-for-all that went on in the press, and how everything was so, wrapped up in service to promote and protect this, what was going on at the time of the dehumanization of black youth all over the country.
You know, I want to say on that for one second, because, mm-hmm. of course, both of us, I think, I knew some of them. I know Yusuf, and one of the founders of my office, Bill Kunstler, defended Yusuf Salam in the trial and subsequently. And what's appalling to me about, I mean, you're right, what happened is there were notices saying we want the death penalty for these guys in the paper. Donald Trump did those. But what's appalling is with the Central Park jogger, and we don't have to get into another subject because people won't understand it, but is that today, as they bring a lawsuit to try and get compensation for the many years of their lives that were lost, for an utterly illegal conviction, but one that they knew was illegal at the time, or that they should have known was illegal, that the city is utterly resisting and has actually subpoenaed the outtakes for that film. And so the city continues in its recalcitrance about an illegal conviction. I know it's an aside, but it's one you and I could spend the whole show on just talking about the subject.
And maybe we will in the future. Maybe we will in the future. But I wanted to act, and actually it does lead into something I was going to ask you. Now, Michael, what do you think is behind this? Because it's one thing to want to punish Bradley Manning. I mean, this is like, you can, and I don't think that's right, but, you can see, you could draw some twisted logic. Okay, we've got to punish this cat. But there's so much more involved in this, it seems. Even in terms of I was thinking about what they've done to him, and the brutality, the turning the other way in terms of what's, not even admitting the barbarous nature of what they've done. But then at the same time, really going even further and further. I mean, the charge of aiding the enemy being tacked on, which is something I think has tremendous potential repercussions throughout society.
Well, you've raised a number of really important issues. Starting with the punishment, pretrial punishment and the torture. That obviously didn't just come out of the brig, because as a psychiatrist said, we've never had a request of ours to take someone out of these kind of conditions, or conditions analogous to these, refused. It was coming from up high. And you ask yourself, why was it coming up high? I mean, what the lawyer said at the earlier phase of the hearings in Bradley Manning is they were trying to break Bradley Manning, or at least force Bradley Manning by really charging him as high as they could, giving him a potential life sentence to testify against my client Julian Assange about anything he might know about Julian Assange and his relationship to the upload of these documents that Bradley Manning allegedly did. Whether he knows anything or not, I don't know. I don't think he does. But the government apparently is trying to make a case against Julian Assange and is willing to try and, you know, break Bradley Manning to do it. That may be one reason. The other reason is probably, you know, the government is seeing its crimes exposed, and they want to punish the exposures. And they don't just want to punish them after trial. They want to send a message to anybody thinking about what Bradley Manning did. Bradley Manning basically almost died in those what you would have to call almost tiger cages, or those animal cages that he was in. And they want to tell people, you do what you did what Bradley Manning allegedly did, you will be put into animal cages. So that's the punishment. But it's, of course, related to what you said. The trading with the aiding the enemy charge is so crazy and so outrageous and so ridiculous as a matter of law that it's hard to believe the judge has sustained it so far. I mean, the idea that Bradley Manning could be charged with it. Because what it essentially does, here's the way it went. It said Bradley Manning exposed documents about U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. He allegedly uploaded those documents about those crimes to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks then published them, and then Al-Qaeda could read them. And therefore, indirectly through WikiLeaks, Bradley Manning is, quote, aiding Al-Qaeda. Well, as you as a journalist know, that makes every single newspaper in the country guilty of aiding Al-Qaeda. When the New York Times publishes some of those cables or documents, and of course, Al-Qaeda is going to read the New York Times on anything to do with, you know, whatever they're up to in Afghanistan or anywhere else, does that make the New York Times guilty of aiding the enemy? I mean, the whole thing is completely crazy. I mean, of course, a whistleblower gives documents to the media. Those documents are going to be read by the world. But it doesn't make you guilty of aiding the enemy. It's the stupidest thing I ever heard. But as stupid as it is, in the context of this country over the last 11 years, it's conceivable. Oh, I still think it's so crazy as to be unlikely that kind of charge could be sustained. It just seems completely nuts to me.
Yeah, unfortunately, the completely nuts is exactly what's real these days. You know, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Ratner. Michael is the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a lawyer for Julian Assange, and he's just come back from attending the first hearing of Bradley Manning, the U.S. Army private accused of leaking hundreds of thousands of secret documents exposing U.S. torture and the war crimes of the U.S. all over the world, actually, especially in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, Michael, you know, when you're talking about this, one of the things that Manning has said is that he basically states, look, these things, what I wanted to do is I wanted to provoke discussion and, you know, exchange of opinions and ideas to get this stuff out in the light so people would know what was going on and they would discuss what the hell is going on here, which to me is actually, I think, part of what they're, you know, just scares the hell out of the system. I think back on Daniel Ellsberg and the kind of thing that actually happened to him and even the attempted murder of Daniel Ellsberg, you know, for revealing the Pentagon Papers. But at the same time, one of the things that's very different now, one of the things that has me very concerned is that Ellsberg was actually, when he did what he did, it was in the context of a massive social upheaval that actually had his back, so to speak. Today, I'm very concerned about where are the people, where are the voices really making themselves felt loud and clear in the streets around Bradley Manning, because it seems to me that has a lot to do with, you know, basically exposing what's going on and having his back.
You know, you've hit a key element. I mean, I think there's two. I think the main one is when Ellsberg exposed the Pentagon Papers is there was a massive anti-war movement in the country, and as you said, had his back. That didn't mean that Nixon didn't go after him for espionage. It didn't mean that they didn't start a grand jury against the New York Times for a while. But in the end, there was tremendous support for what Ellsberg did, and he joined the pantheon of heroes of this country. As we know from Bradley Manning, you know, as someone said in a funny Onion tweet, they said now that, you know, General Petraeus has been canned, and everybody's reading about General Petraeus, they realize there's an Afghan war going on. Well, the problem on the Bradley Manning case is exactly what you said. There is no mass movement in this country to support Bradley Manning right now. There's a lot more people than... I don't want to denigrate what there is, because there's a lot. In fact, David Coombs, Bradley's attorney, said yesterday that the reason Bradley Manning eventually got out of the torture conditions in Quantico was because of the mass objections and revelations that came out about what was happening. I mean, he said at on one point, there were 74,000 emails saying, what's happening to Bradley Manning? So there is, you know, it's a movement that you and I are aware of. It's not a mass movement in that way, but there's a huge number of people who understand what Bradley Manning's importance is and are very sympathetic to him. But I agree with you. The big difference here is Manning's work did not fall into a mass movement that can defend him. Look, it's growing, and when I was at a meeting yesterday in Washington with David Coombs, the lawyer, there were a lot of people there. David Coombs says his website got 700,000 hits on this or something like that over this. So there's a lot of people interested and out there, but really the forces are so against Bradley Manning, Jeremy Hammond, and Julian Assange right now in this country, the so-called, you know, guardians of our press freedom, newspapers and otherwise, that we've got a problem.
Yeah, and it's, to me, it's just a question. Look, you know, you think once you know what's real and what's reality and what's going on and the truth about what's going on, it doesn't mean you automatically will do the right thing. And I think that's something that's really confronting a lot of people now: is are you going to do the right thing or not?
That's right. I mean, I think that's right. These cases are really important because we're at a major point where, you know, as you said, war crimes and everything are completely secret. The publisher Julian Assange, the journalist, and two whistleblowers the government's really going after them because we're at a point where they want to keep as much secret as they can. It's worse than I've ever seen it in my 40 years of law practice. They see, especially because of this digital issue that's coming up, that people can actually get this information. The government wants to send a message: don't be a whistleblower. And don't publish what whistleblowers give you.
All right, Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Okay, and we'll have you back again soon to talk about a whole lot of things, man.
Right, I'd appreciate that.
All right,
terrific.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Man. Take care. All right, that brings us to the end of another edition of The Michael Slate Show. And I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And I want to thank all of my guests for today. I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. But before we go, how about I leave you with this quote from Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. There is nothing more unrealistic than the idea of reforming this system into something that would come anywhere near being in the interests of the great majority of people and ultimately of humanity as a whole. Again, that's from Bob Avakian, and you can find that in his book, Basics. We're going to go out now with Revolution Rap from the Joey Jefferson Band. Check this out.